Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. On today's programme, the designer of the National Museum of African American History and Culture reflects on the museum's significance.
That day when we opened and Barack came, Bush came, Clinton came, it was like this extraordinary kind of moment. My mother, who's in her 80s, and we sort of sat there watching this thing and started crying, and it was just sort of like the most powerful experience that I'd ever had in my life.
Architect David Adjaye talks about the Washington, D.C. Museum and about how African architecture is getting the respect it deserves. That's coming up. First up, though, President Trump's campaign speeches made it very clear that as president, he would build a great and beautiful wall along the U.S.-Mexican border. Customs and Border Protection, or CBP, officials held an open call for bids for the multi-billion dollar construction contract. Some 200 applications were accepted. It was around now that journalists were expecting to be going down to San Diego to look at prototypes of the finalists for this supposed border wall, and yet nothing has materialized. Architectural journalist Ian Vollner looked for answers why nothing has appeared, and he wrote about it in an article for Foreign Policy magazine entitled "The Trump Administration Doesn't Want a Winner for the Wall Competition." He joined me in our studio to talk about it.
In a by now familiar pattern, the president appears to have overpromised, especially in terms of speed. One of the mantras of the campaign, we all recall, was "It will happen, and it will happen so fast, you have no idea." We all had an idea. Anybody with any familiarity with government contracting, even private construction, knew that a project of this scale was likely to take a very long time if it were to materialize ever. So, unsurprisingly, the idea of breaking ground within the first 100 days of his administration turned out to be impossible. The prototypes were supposed to have begun in June. At this point, they'll be lucky to break ground before the summer is out. They did succeed in getting from 200-plus applicants in the initial round of the competition, which closed in early March, to now 20, supposedly, firms under consideration to move on to the prototype stage. What really required some digging was trying to figure out who's on the 20-firm shortlist. The government has been, I can't say unprecedentedly quiet, but certainly unusually discreet in trying to keep the names of the 20 out of the media. One of them ran afoul of that proviso very quickly, a contractor in Arizona called Dennis O'Leary, who runs a firm called Dark Pulse Technologies. In casting as wide a net as I could, I happened on another, a contractor in Massachusetts. The firm is called Riverdale Mills. Its CEO is Jim Knott Jr. I then found yet a third party. That party declined to be identified by name.
So we'll get to some of these points in a moment. But let's start with Dennis O'Leary. He's in a way a kind of character in your story. Tell us about Dennis, why he came forward, and what it was he was proposing.
O'Leary's firm is responsible for, they have a patented technology, fiber optic sensors, which is meant to help detect any activity around the border and improve the interdiction of cross-border traffic. I don't say that he quite regrets it now, but it was obviously something of a daring move to put himself out in front of the story like that.
Because of the politics surrounding this, because of the fact that contractors who put their names forward were getting death threats. You had elected officials in Sacramento saying these people should be blackballed from future state projects. It really became a highly charged position to take to simply put your name forward for this wall. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, I mean, that certainly seemed to be one of the main reasons why CPB was eager for people to keep their identities a secret. It was because of fear of just that kind of reaction. Some other folks who had been selected for the second phase 20 round withdrew their name from consideration because of threats, both political and physical.
So these folks that you reached out to were developing prototypes, is that right? And were they getting any financial support
from the administration for this?
Phase
two does not involve building the prototypes just yet. It only involves answering a series of questionnaires from CBP to see which are the best to move forward to the actual prototype stage. They expect that number to be as low as 4 to 8. O'Leary not from Riverdale and the anonymous finalist, are responding to these questionnaires in hopes that they will be able to get out there into the San Diego desert for the prototype stage, because that is the only opportunity they're going to have, at least in the near term, to make any money. CBP has $20 million set aside for this within their current operating budget that did not require a special allocation of Congress, and that will be the money that will go towards the construction of those prototypes whenever they begin construction.
So it's still at a whenever stage. These guys don't really know what's happening next.
There's all kinds of unknowns which are not calculated for when you have someone like Donald Trump lording it over from above telling you to rush, rush, rush.
It also seems that somewhat belatedly, President Trump has discovered that there already is a border wall or some form of protection along something like two-thirds of the length of the border. And then where there isn't currently physical structure, it's because much of that stretch is unbuildable.
The natural barrier is more of an effective deterrent than any human wall is likely to be. The cost of erecting it when you already have a desert is ridiculous. The stretches that are not presently walled are stretches that are so inhospitable that those prepared to go that far have got to be really genuinely desperate. The portions of the border that are most notionally porous are those that are essentially urban in character or semi-urban. There are cities that straddle the border. Those portions already have walls. Walls as high and as thick as they're likely to get, any additional improvements following the designs of any of the current competitors would only be marginally less penetrable than the walls that now stand, and those walls are imperfect.
Do you think we're ever going to see anything?
Yeah, I'm fairly confident we'll see some sections of prototype sometime before the year is out. They'll at least get underway. And the companies with the proprietary technology know how to produce them relatively quickly. Riverdale Mills specializes in a wire mesh system.
That's normally used for lobster fishing.
Lobsters, clams, oysters.
Immigrants.
It sounds more Bush League than it is. In point of fact, Knott's company has supplied their proprietary system to a number of different applications, including sections of existing wall along the southern border and defensive installations in Kuwait. The designs that seem to be in contention for the 20 Mills O'Leary and the anonymous bidder, from an architectural perspective, are pretty prosaic. Lobster wire mesh. O'Leary, as much as the renderings bear out, it's just a big concrete slab with a sensor system inside it.
No beautiful wall. No
walls
with monorails
wall.
Along the top, or walls used to engrave memorials, or walls used in a somewhat more conceptual way as people had envisioned.
Sure. In fact, as recently as just scarcely, a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, the president himself endorsed the idea of a solar paneled wall, one that would be capable of paying for itself and generating energy for the region. Anyone who knows anything about solar panels knows that the higher the concentration, the easier they are to clean and maintain. And especially when you're in an environment like, a desert, which tends to be rather dusty, it would be effectively impossible to clean 2,000 linear miles of solar photovoltaics at anything less than astronomical cost.
About 3 months ago, we spoke to a fellow in San Diego who was submitting, in the first stage, and he was submitting, he said, because he simply wanted to improve on the wall that was already there. But even at the time, when we asked him then, do you really think this wall's going to happen? He said, no, even though he was applying. So did you get the sense from talking to these three why they'd applied, given the firestorm of criticism many of them ran into, and then the fact that the thing might not even be built?
For a lot of these firms, the decision was less complicated than one might assume. For one thing, their heaviest hitting competitors had already taken themselves all out of contention. The major design build firms in America almost uniformly bowed out and said they would not submit. AECOM, all the biggies. So field was wide open. These firms, the three that are in the second stage that I found, are all very experienced with government contracting. Even the lobster mesh makers know how the game is played. Dark Pulse and the anonymous bidder both have multiple contracts outstanding with the government or under consideration now. in the border area. The Riverdale Mills CEO, Jim Knott Jr., was a little bit more emphatic. He's citing a certain kind of patriotic motive. For Mills, this was an opportunity to show what American workers could do if given the chance at whatever the surrounding politics. He insisted it was not a political decision for them. The negative knocks that they've all come in for, even that, at the very least you can say, is we hadn't heard of Riverdale Mills before. We certainly have now. And as they say, all publicity is good publicity.
That was Ian Vollner talking about the bidding process for Trump's border wall. He wrote about it for Foreign Policy magazine. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. After this break, world-renowned architect David Adjaye explains why African architecture is taking its place on the world stage.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
With DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. The architect David Adjaye was born in Tanzania to a Ghanaian diplomat. He studied in London and found his first clients in Britain's art world. And he's gone on to design numerous buildings around the world. But last year was a game changer. He received a knighthood from Queen Elizabeth, meaning you can call him Sir David. And then came the opening of his most important commission to date, the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. We met David recently when he was in LA to speak at the Dwell on Design conference. He kept mum about rumours that he is soon to build in LA, but we talked about topics ranging from emerging African architecture to improving social housing. We started with the Smithsonian Museum.
You know when you sort of work on something and you don't quite see what's happening with it? But that day when we opened and Barack came, Bush came, Clinton came. It was like this extraordinary kind of moment. And I took my mother, who's in her 80s, and we sort of sat there watching this thing and started crying. And it was just sort of like the most kind of powerful experience that I'd ever had in my life. It was just, you realize that you'd become part of an important piece of history. I mean, I'm still processing it, and it's extraordinarily humbling. I mean, I get messages every day to even now, just thanking me or talking about the project through social media or something. And it's just extraordinary to me how much resonance it's having. But, you know, I was so upset that it took so long to make this project.
Taken a long time for the country to do it or the construction process?
The country to do it.
Right.
The construction process was 8 years, which is the fastest Smithsonian that's ever been built. We've broken all records.
But the quest to get the building built went back decades.
And so
that felt like an affront to a community that needed this.
Exactly. I think the community has always been in this second-class position. It's only kind of post-civil rights that it started to have a chance to have a voice in the front seat. And you can imagine that from that point to this sort of century, this new century we're in, there's been a struggle to feel like they are equal in the idea of America. And it's really interesting how architecture is part of the symbolism that creates that sense of being in the front seat. And there are just simply not any monuments that celebrate or talk about who they are and what they've done to build America. You know, labor and building cities and building America was one of the most direct ways in which the Black community contributed and kind of professionalized themselves. They just built canals. They built systems. They were the guys who were not just picking cotton on the field, they were also developing the irrigation systems.
They built the White House, Obama reminded us all.
It's a fact.
The design for the museum celebrates this community with an emphatic architectural statement. A three-tiered upturned corona with bronze-coated aluminum cladding, its decorative perforations echo the traditional ironwork of enslaved Africans and freed African Americans in places like Charleston, Savannah, and New Orleans. It's both utterly different from the neoclassical buildings on the Mall while having a grandeur to match. Ajay says the design unites influences from Northern European classicism and a Southern classical language that was carried through Africa by the Bantu peoples.
So in the sort of European evolution of the classical language, it becomes about ornament and detail in the sense that it becomes about a soft light that reveals detail and the way in which light has to be articulated to strengthen form. In the Southern trajectory, it becomes about silhouettes because it's not about needing light because there's too much light. So actually the profile and the geometry and form shape becomes very powerful in Southern architecture.
So David, part of the original team that you worked with on the Smithsonian was the African-American architect Max Bond. He passed away during the process, but he had always dreamed of a pan-African architecture, correct? Now there are several African architects who are gaining global attention. You, of course, and then there's Francis Kere from Burkina Faso, who designed this year's Serpentine Pavilion in London. There's also Nigerian Kunle Adeyemi and Ghanaian Joe Addo. Do you think we're seeing the emergence of a kind of new, fresh architectural language that's a fusion of African and Western traditions?
I think that undoubtedly there's a new language on the landscape, and it's a huge part of the world, and it has sort of been behind in terms of its development, and it now is becoming modern, but also by the relationship with America, Africa, Europe, and America are somehow kind of interlinked through this global contract, you know, that happened then.
Well, it's very interesting because obviously what we've all been exposed to quite a lot of over the last, certainly over the last 25 years, is the implications of the digital revolution and the way in which the digital is expressing itself in architecture.
And
then we have many of your buildings, and then we have buildings by some of the others that we've just mentioned. And there is a complexity, but the complexity seems to derive a lot from craft.
It's absolutely about craft. I mean, there are lots of kind of speculations about robots taking over and doing that, and that's all a very interesting future that's to come. But we're in this stage where still buildings are put together. Even if they're prefabricated, they're still put together by the hand and assembled by the hand. And there's something about this tradition of making all that sort of work on the Smithsonian is using computers. It's using algorithms. It's using all these tools, and because it's about kind of creating production systems that can allow it to be made and easily put together and assembled and organized by human beings. So I'm very interested in the use of computers to make sort of extreme complexity producible. But I'm just not interested in the computer just as a kind of...
As an end in itself.
As an end in itself.
Many of Ajay's buildings have a deep, intense, and often dark appearance. His Moscow School of Management, however, has a surface of pixelated whites, grays, and blues. What unites the designs, he says, is the interplay with light.
I think that I'm fascinated by the way in which architecture produces shadow as a kind of form, and as a result, has to kind of manipulate light. And in a way, that discussion about manipulating light is really about then the orientation or the latitude and longitude that you're in. In northern hemispheres, the lack of light means that you're spending all your time trying to get as much light as possible. But actually, as you get closer to the sun, the more close to the equator it becomes, the more dramatic the manipulation. And I felt that from everything from being in my father's village in the tropics right through to colonial houses that I've enjoyed that had to kind of negotiate this before air conditioning was invented, et cetera, et cetera.
You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. I'm talking with Sir David Ajay. An exhibition of his work called Form, Heft, Material is currently on display at the Garage Museum in Gorky Park in Moscow. Since we conducted this interview, Ajay was appointed by the Mayor of London to a shortlist of 50 architects to help create a more, quote, socially and economically inclusive London as part of a Good Growth by Design programme. This announcement follows the public outrage at last month's Grenfell Tower fire in the London Borough of Kensington, in which a presumed 80 people lost their lives. Now, one of Ajay's more recent projects is the Sugar Hill Complex in New York's Harlem, providing affordable housing alongside a preschool and a children's museum.
It's really my first major project in New York. And I was very careful about what project I wanted to kind of arrive in New York with. And I was, you know, there were lots. It was at a time when this was a sort of incredible sort of explosion of luxury buildings being built and the media only concentrating on the luxury projects. And I absolutely didn't want anything to do with it. I didn't want to, at that time, be talking about another luxury tower in New York. It just didn't seem like it was even interesting. And I was fascinated by what the kind of the condition of housing was in the city. And I realized through research that actually the homeless issue was a major issue still. There were kind of great kind of attempts by different mayors to sort of deal with it. And then this competition came up to build the first designed homeless housing project in New York, which was like astonishing to me. You know, it was like, so we went to the competition and we won it. We brought ideas to the table. We wanted to talk about New York housing. We wanted to talk about homelessness and this idea that some of the most creative people we know in the music sector end up sort of, not everyone makes it. In fact, 90% of them don't make it. Most of them become these extremely talented people who become the people that are busking on the trains and fall out and die in the streets. And it was just such a horrific story to me. So I wanted to kind of really get involved in making housing that really spoke to the city about this issue. And so that was the project. You know, it's mostly filled with ex-jazz men. You know, there's about 30% jazz musicians. It's really for first-time families that, you know, allows them to kind of step up the ladder. And it's built in a kind of up-and-coming neighborhood in East Harlem, in this neighborhood that was becoming more gentrified. And I think at the beginning, there was a kind of resistance. People were like, oh my God, well, we don't want a homeless project next to us, you know, and all the issues. And even the things like the color of the building, which I let the community choose. I gave them many choices. We can make a bright white building. We can make a black building. We can make a brown building. And they all chose the black building.
Really?
And everybody thinks that I did it because, you know, I have a kind of thing.
Because you're David Ajay.
David Ajay and I do dark buildings and that's all. I've said, no, I'm happy to kind of have a selection. Here it is. They all chose the black building.
Really?
Yeah.
Did they say why they chose the black?
It was emotional, I think. They just felt, I think there was a sense that that the sense of who they were that was not somehow visual in the city. So it was a kind of the building took on this notion of sort of saying that there was a black presence here.
So you worked with the future residents,
yeah,
of this project. And that brings me to actually another question, which is just the way you approach some of your projects. Mm. You may remember a former student of yours, Janus Wyman, who now lives in LA,
yes,
and has become famous in her own right as the co-creator of the Pussy Hat Project,
yeah,
the pink knitted caps. And we did an interview, and in the course of the interview, she talked about your influence on her as a teacher. And how, I guess, at Harvard, you had told the students that in order to really embark on a project before just starting designing, they needed to get out there and talk to people. Not even just talk to the client or the future occupants, but just people.
Mm.
Is that
golden rule?
Is
one
that,
of my golden rules.
I was going to say,
yeah,
is that one of your golden rules?
It's one of my
and you
rules.
Apply it to your own process.
Yeah. Well, I would say that architects are very quick to start sketching before they really understand the context. And I said, the thing is that sketching is actually the easiest part of what we do. The struggle is not to somehow start sketching and finding some kind of form. The struggle is to make sense of the form to the place. And the struggle is to make sense of the form to the community. So, and to do that, you just simply can't observe from afar. You have to somehow engage. I don't need for it to be about some kind of like, I've lived there for 30 years or anything. It just needs a kind of, almost a kind of detective-like engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And then from that, projects would be birthed. And projects that made sense rather than projects that were given by municipalities or developers or, you know, it was a way to see if architecture could evolve through an understanding of how society evolves, which can help our societies kind of deal with the complexities of the modern world.
Your father was a diplomat.
Yes.
Do you think you learned some diplomatic skills?
I think, I mean, my father was my role model. So I'm indebted to who I am through him and my mother. So I know that he taught us to be inquisitive, to be always never assumptive, to understand that the world is polyphonous and diasporic. It's kind of and mutating all the time.
That was Sir David Adjaye, architect of many buildings, most prominently the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of African American History and Culture. Now let's go back to Ian Vollmer. He's the architecture historian and critic who joined us earlier in this programme to talk about the border wall. He's also written about David Adjaye's work and about social housing. He happens to live near Adjaye's Harlem project at 155th Street and says it's a tough-looking high-rise itself. I asked him whether he felt Adjaye was a good fit for the group that's been selected by the Mayor of London to work on more socially and economically inclusive housing.
Yes, I do. David's project on 155th Street is a different beast than Grenfell or the others. It has multiple uses. There's a school, a museum. There's a lot of functional dynamism packed into a reasonably small space. Even the tower, which, yes, is a little bit aggressive, has between the patterning and that very rich black facade treatment, has a subtlety to it that would have been alien in the early 70s. When I profiled David for the Wall Street Journal a couple of years back, one of the points I was keen to make is that David's not necessarily a form giver in the sense that some architects are, like a, I suppose the phrase was first applied to Le Corbusier, and it could equally be said of Gehry. He's a kind of a cultural mixmaster. He has a very, very solid grasp on the way that different global cultures play back against each other, in particular with a lot of his work, as with, for example, the new Smithsonian Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C. There's this deft intermingling of artistic and aesthetic traditions of sub-Saharan Africa with Western monumentalism with something faintly modernistic. And he recognizes the way, for example, that modern architecture was informed by the arts and design of Africa at its inception and how, in turn, modern architecture infiltrated sub-Saharan Africa. These kinds of echoes, these kinds of loops, he's very sensitive to. The result isn't always the most compelling, or it's certainly compelling. It doesn't always resolve an otherwise already complex urban condition. Sometimes it makes it even more vexed because that's how complex and how rich the thinking behind the project is. And he absolutely is committed to a certain vision of social design, and I'm glad to hear that he's in that group.
That's architectural writer and historian Ian Vollmer. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.